Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Reverend Peter Morales, president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, who discusses the repercussions of the grand jury decision not to indict the Ferguson police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, and the national issue of police violence in communities of color. Daniel Altshuler of the group Make the Road New York, who examines the scope and impact of President Obama's executive order offering temporary legal status to millions of undocumented immigrants. And Amanda Allen of the Center for Reproductive Rights, who explains why many pro-choice activists are bracing for renewed efforts to further restrict women's access to abortion when newly elected conservative politicians take their seats in Washington and in state legislatures. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian reports Tanzania's government is backtracking on promises made to the indigenous Maasai tribe. Officials are moving forward with plans for a controversial wildlife corridor allowing a firm link to Dubai's royal family to lead big game hunts near the Serengeti National Park. In the process, nearly 40,000 Maasai pastoralists would be evicted from their traditional land. Under the plan, the Maasai would be forced off their land used for animal grazing, a key part of their nomadic life. Tanzania's prime minister has offered to compensate members of the Maasai tribe with over $500,000 in development projects. However, Maasai leaders have rejected the proposed deal. An online petition was launched last year by the international activist group Avaaz.org, which gathered over 1.7 million signatures and initiated a social media campaign opposing the wildlife corridor. Alex Wilkes, campaign director for Avaaz, observed, "The Maasai stare out from every tourism poster, but the Tanzanian government wants to kick them off their land so foreign royalty can hunt elephants there. Treating the Maasai as the great unwanted," he said, "would be a disaster for Tanzania's reputation." On the 25th anniversary of Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution, when pro-democracy protesters peacefully overthrew the communist regime, anti-government demonstrators flooded the streets of Prague to condemn President Miloš Zeman for his criticism of European sanctions against Russia. During a ceremony unveiling a plaque honoring the actions of student activists in 1989, protesters threw eggs and heckled Zeman, who was elected in 2013. They waved red cards like those used to signal a penalty in soccer matches. Zeman has blasted European sanctions against Moscow and labeled the dissident rock group Pussy Riot as hooligans. Outside of big cities like Prague, President Zeman remains popular. The civil war in Ukraine has put many former communist states in Eastern Europe in an awkward position. They feel pressure to join their European allies in condemning Moscow for annexing Crimea and backing pro-Russian separatists, but they don't want to disrupt long-standing commercial ties with Russia. In Chicago, it's illegal to sell prepared foods on the street. Vendors face arrest and fines up to $1,000. Chicago is one of the few big cities in the U.S. where officials refuse to issue business licenses to street vendors who sell prepared foods. The illicit nature of street vending in immigrant neighborhoods cuts down on the income vendors can earn. Many street vendors are already locked out of the labor market because of age discrimination, child care responsibilities, and immigration status. But pro-immigrant allies on the Chicago City Council are pushing for a new city ordinance that would legalize the sale of prepared foods on the street. The proposed ordinance would issue licenses to vendors who cook their food in a city-inspected kitchen. Predictably, the vending bill faces stiff opposition from Chicago's restaurant industry. Yet street vendors, mostly low-income immigrants, could increase the sale of fresh foods into poor communities. Beth Krieger, who runs an entrepreneur clinic at the University of Chicago Law School, told the news magazine In These Times, "It's kind of perverse in this city that we worry about people's access to healthy foods, and yet we ban people from selling soup in a cart in neighborhoods where there aren't any grocery stores." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Now Not long after St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough announced the decision of the Missouri grand jury not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, who shot and killed unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown on August 9th, the streets of Ferguson exploded in anger. After a dozen buildings were looted and set on fire, and more than 150 gunshots were heard, local police fired tear gas on protesters and arrested 82 in a night filled with chaos and rage. Since the grand jury decision, mostly peaceful protest rallies have been held in more than a dozen cities across the U.S. An attorney representing Michael Brown's family, Benjamin Crump, responded to the grand jury decision by charging that the jury process itself was broken. Many attorneys and legal observers across the country echoed Crump's criticism, noting that Prosecutor McCullough's decision not to recommend any charges to members of the grand jury was highly unusual. McCullough was also criticized for remarks blatantly attempting to discredit several witnesses during the grand jury announcement. A Justice Department investigation into the possible violation of Michael Brown's civil rights and the Ferguson Police Department's alleged use of excessive force is ongoing. In remarks in Chicago the day after the grand jury announcement, and after riots erupted in the streets of Ferguson, President Obama condemned the violence while pledging to redouble his efforts to find solutions to the distrust between law enforcement and minority communities. The president observed that the problem is not just a Ferguson problem, it's an American problem. Mr. Obama has assigned Attorney General Eric Holder the task of leading regional discussions to address the root cause of the crisis in Ferguson. Your reporter spoke with Reverend Peter Morales, president of the National Unitarian Universalist Association. Here he discusses the repercussions of the grand jury decision not to indict police officer Darren Wilson and the larger national issue of police violence in communities of color.
No, I have not seen all the evidence, and there's a different kind of standard in a criminal proceeding. However, the fact that they decided not to indict this officer doesn't address the whole larger problem. Is why is an unarmed teenager ends up being killed because he was, you know, walking down the middle of a street that has hardly any traffic on it at all, and the people often walk down it. The situation that allows what should have been no more than a minor encounter, if any encounter at all, to escalate into this, that's the real problem that faces, you know, hundreds and thousands of communities all over the country, and that's what we need to address, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
What is it that you would like to see happen at this point in time when so many people are obviously dissatisfied with this decision of the grand jury?
It's hard when somebody is that angry, when any of us is that angry, to hear a voice of calm as anything other than the voice of sort of the other side. You know, my concern is that innocent people will get hurt, that innocent small shop owners will suffer harm. And more largely, the real challenge here is to take this understandable and justifiable frustration and anger and channel that into changing the system, into changing the way police forces do their work, the way police officers are recruited, the kind of oversight that exists, and to change the entire culture of fear and hatred between races that allows this kind of a situation to develop. So to say that more briefly, we've got to channel this anger in a way that it produces change, not just simply expresses frustration. That's going to happen, but then something positive needs to happen.
Reverend Morales, what would your advice be to people who have lost confidence in our nation's judicial system?
Well, I've heard the phrase used before, don't agonize, organize. And it's a little simplistic, but it's also true that it's to get involved in the process, to elect people who are respectful of human rights, to bring pressure upon district attorney's offices and police departments all over the country, and to hold them to account and to engage in really rigorous oversight of them. And that's what's going to eventually change this.
I wanted you to comment, if you would, on something that came out of the Supreme Court surrounding their decision to overturn a key element of the Voting Rights Act And I connect it with the situation in Ferguson in that the Supreme Court's decision intimated that racism was no longer an issue in the United States of America. It's obvious to many people that that conclusion is wrong on the part of the Supreme Court. But what is it, do you think, is necessary in this country to both recognize the continuing issue of racism in the United States and to take a constructive approach to addressing it and hopefully reducing that form of prejudice and racism?
Well, as you said, I mean, anyone who goes sort of outside and walks around different parts of the United States and believes that racism isn't an issue is in a state of shocking denial. Racism is all around us, and it's not just this sort of vague sense of it. There's all kinds of evidence of it. The rates of incarceration of especially of African Americans, the systematic disenfranchisement, I mean, the conscious attempts, sadly, by Republican Party leadership in the last years to make it more difficult for African Americans to vote. I mean, we face a situation in this country where the forces of reaction, which are fed by fear, have gathered a great deal of power. And it's going to take a long and disciplined effort by people of goodwill, which is the majority of Americans, to pay attention to this and to undo it in all kinds of ways. I mean, part of it is political action. Part of it is changing the culture. And while they're positive signs, they're also very, very troubling signs in America. And it's very painful to me. And I also see people in my religious movement, Unitarian Universalists, but people of goodwill of all faiths, paying more and more attention to this and taking action. And I take hope in that.
Just a final question, Reverend Morales, and that is,
sure,
we have seen many young people become active on this issue, both in Ferguson, Missouri, and across the country, where young people of color have been shot down by police. There's a roiling anger, and this particular case seemed to bring out people as never before to become active. What is your message to young people who may be shocked and disappointed that this grand jury did not indict the officer who shot Michael Brown, who may be disheartened to the point to give up on peaceful protests and either drop out of activism altogether or take another, possibly more violent route?
You have every right to be angry and to be frustrated. And if you look at the long span of history, the civil rights movement, the anti-slavery movement, the movement more recently for LGBT rights, all of these movements that produced real and positive change in our culture didn't happen overnight. And they happened because people stuck with it. They were in it for the long haul. Again, with the people who want to limit your rights, what they want you to do is to disengage, because that absolutely plays into their hands.
That was Reverend Peter Morales, president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. For more perspectives on the issue of police violence in communities of color across the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Obama announced his long-anticipated executive order on immigration in a televised address from the White House on November 20th. Undeterred by the Democrats' recent loss of the U.S. Senate in the midterm election, Mr. Obama offered temporary legal status to more than 4 million undocumented immigrants, along with an indefinite reprieve from deportation and the issuing of work permits. The response from the Republican Party was immediate and hostile, with GOP congressional leaders threatening to do everything possible to block Mr. Obama's initiative. A handful of conservative legislators talked about launching impeachment proceedings, while others openly discussed having the president arrested for violating the Constitution and predicted violence erupting across the country in response to the order. The president explained that he took executive action because of the House GOP leadership's ongoing refusal to hold a vote on comprehensive immigration reform legislation that had passed in the Senate with bipartisan support in June 2013. He asserted that it was important that he act unilaterally to prioritize the deportation of criminals and recent arrivals, while sparing those who have lived in the country without documentation for at least 5 years and have roots including children who are U.S. citizens. Mr. Obama and his supporters maintain that there is a long history of presidents, both Democratic and Republican, issuing executive orders, exercising prosecutorial discretion, dating back to Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Many grassroots pro-immigration groups across the country took credit for the president's executive order, pointing out the pressure they had applied in their years-long campaign that included protests and civil disobedience actions. Your reporter spoke with Daniel Altshuler, Long Island coordinator with the immigrant rights group Make the Road New York, who examines the scope and impact of President Obama's executive order, offering temporary legal status to millions of undocumented immigrants.
This is something with tremendous legal precedent, what the president has done. The president has the authority and the responsibility to enforce immigration laws and to also determine the priorities for how that's going to happen. And so this type of deferred action policy, these types of executive actions have been taken by Democratic and Republican presidents for decades. So this is something well within legal precedent, and we're very, we're excited. And members of the immigrant community that we work with are excited that the president has opted to take action as previous presidents have done before.
So when Republicans complain that President Obama is acting like a king or an emperor, acting outside the Constitution and the law, threats of impeachment and imprisonment and all that, based primarily on the fact that they say he's granted amnesty, do you take it as a deliberate misstatement of fact, given what we know about this executive order in black and white?
You know, it really is just political posturing. It is folks, particularly in the Republican leadership, who have failed to take action on this and frankly have, there was a Senate bill that included a path to citizenship for 11 million undocumented people, as well as other provisions to fix our broken immigration system that passed overwhelmingly in the Senate almost a year and a half ago. And since then, since the bill moved over to the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, it went absolutely nowhere. And despite having the votes to pass, a vote was never allowed to take place. So this is political posturing by the same folks who refused to take action on this critical issue. And we are, again, excited about what the president has done, and we believe it is, it is a really important step forward. It is not a panacea. It is not the final solution. Ultimately, we do need Congress to still legislate on this matter because, the president acting alone is not able to grant citizenship to the millions of undocumented immigrants who live in this country. That is going to require an act of Congress.
What's the reaction among the immigrant community that you work with? Were they surprised by this? Was it expected? And what about the actual benefits that will accrue to many of the folks that are friends of yours and you work with daily?
Sure. I mean, I can speak to you about some of the activities we've undertaken with our members. We had watch parties both on Thursday night for the president's first address from the White House and then also from his speech in Las Vegas on Friday. And there was just tremendous energy in the room, and folks were very excited about the announcement. We had a lot of folks there who would directly benefit from the president's announcement and this new policy. And the reason for that excitement is, we have folks who for a very long time have lived in fear of being separated from their loved ones, something that no one should have to live with. And what this announcement, once it becomes implemented, once people are able to apply for this type of relief, will mean is that folks are able to not live in fear of being separated from their children, are able to apply to have work authorization, to be able to apply for better jobs and earn a better living and suffer less exploitation in the workplace. This really does mean a tremendous change in people's lives, and it really is historic, not just at the sort of national level, but in the granular details of how people are living their lives each day.
Daniel, when you look to the future, an ongoing effort by many pro-immigration groups who are seeking a permanent solution to the immigration crisis in the country, how is it that you're going to pursue a campaign to ensure that some of the relief given by this executive order is transformed into something more permanent and, most importantly, a path to citizenship?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our organization and organizations like Make the Road New York around the country are committed to building a base within the community, that is to say, building membership-based organizations where immigrant New Yorkers, immigrant residents of Connecticut, immigrants from all over the country are able to speak for themselves and are able to articulate the needs of their community. And so, you know, this is an important step forward and an accomplishment for our movement. But what we also need to continue to do is use this as a movement building moment where our organizations are able to continue to build and thrive and grow to be able to take this fight into the next congressional session that begins next year and make sure that we're able to both defend what has been done against any of these potential spurious attacks that you mentioned earlier, and also continue to advocate for a broader solution in the months and years to come. And that's something that I think, you know, at the same time that we folks have been celebrating an accomplishment over the past week, they've also been rededicating themselves to the fight ahead.
That was Daniel Altshuler, Long Island coordinator with the immigrant rights group Make the Road New York. Find links to more discussion on the issue of comprehensive immigration reform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The past 2 years have seen escalating attacks on abortion rights at the state level, as conservative majorities took control of many state legislatures and governor's offices. According to the Guttmacher Institute, more anti-choice legislation was passed between 2011 and 2013 than in the previous 10 years. Now, in the wake of the 2014 midterm elections, Republican majorities and supermajorities will be taking control of even more legislatures, and additional Republican governors have been elected to office. While anti-abortion activists in Tennessee celebrated state voters' November 5th passage of Amendment 1, a measure that gives state lawmakers more power to restrict abortions, pro-choice groups took credit for defeating so-called personhood ballot initiatives in Colorado and North Dakota, which would have granted rights to human embryos and fetuses. Although the issue of reproductive rights were not the focus of most campaign debates in this election, just as they were barely mentioned in the 2010 midterms, once in office, many GOP legislators have made attacks on abortion rights and birth control a priority agenda item. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Amanda Allen, state legislative counsel with the Center for Reproductive Rights. Here she explains why many pro-choice activists are bracing for renewed efforts to further restrict women's access to abortion when newly elected conservative politicians take office.
See a majority of anti-choice governors moving into the 2015 session, and we will also see a majority of state legislatures governed by two houses that are likely to be anti-choice. What really happened this election is we lost ground in a couple of states that really had legislatures that were mixed choice, that maybe weren't super, super hard right anti-abortion, but that could be moving in that direction. And so that is one of the reasons why we think that we might be seeing more state legislatures that are, on the whole, more anti-choice. So we've really seen abortion access limited to a very severe degree in states where there's only one clinic left. And those states are North Dakota, South Dakota, Mississippi, Missouri, and Wyoming. North Dakota in particular, every year that their legislature is in session, their legislators come in and propose and pass bill after bill after bill, really, really directly attacking that remaining abortion clinic in the state. You might recall that North Dakota faced a 6-week abortion ban last year that the Center for Reproductive Rights successfully got a federal court to block. That was one of several anti-abortion bills considered by the North Dakota legislature last year. Now, North Dakota only meets every other year, and so we did not see those types of restrictions in North Dakota this year, but we are absolutely gearing up for another tough session there. Also, Mississippi. Mississippi is another of the states that has only one abortion clinic left, and that clinic is also hanging on by a court order. The Mississippi legislature back in 2012 passed a law that sounds like a good idea. It requires abortion providers to have local hospital admitting privileges. And part of the strategy is to make that kind of requirement sound benign and sound easy to comply with. But of course, the providers in the state have been unable to obtain privileges, not because they provide substandard care, but because the abortion is such a politicized issue in the state that not a single hospital would grant those privileges. And so we've got a federal court order blocking that requirement from taking effect. But like I said, that clinic is also hanging on by a court order. And so those are some just a couple examples of states in our country where abortion access really is depending on a woman's zip code and where she lives.
Amanda Allen, I know abortion rights had majority support among American voters for decades, but I think that's changed.
Well, the polling is actually very compelling on this question. 7 in 10 Americans do not believe that abortion should be banned and do not believe that Roe versus Wade should be overturned. So those are the polling figures that we have. The other thing I would like to say is that, by and large, this election, when abortion rights and when reproductive health were squarely before voters as an issue, we won. And there are two compelling examples of that at the ballot box in North Dakota and in Colorado. Voters in both of those states faced a question about whether they wanted to insert fetal personhood language into their state constitutions, which would, of course, ban abortion and could possibly ban other very common forms of contraception, and in North Dakota even impact things like end-of-life care. And so in both instances this election, voters overwhelmingly rejected those. And so I think that really supports the overall numbers that we have on our side, which is, again, to say that 7 in 10 Americans do not want to see their politicians meddling with the constitutional right to abortion. They do not want to see those constitutional protections be overturned.
But voters also support a lot of restrictions on access to abortion, right?
I think what we found is that when these issues are very can be very complicated, and our opposition has been able to frame their side as being on the side of women's health and safety. But I think what we've seen is that once voters hear that the impact of these laws and the intent of these laws is actually to make abortion so difficult to obtain that it becomes really a right on paper rather than a right in reality, that they don't support those kinds of measures.
That was Amanda Allen, state legislative counsel with the Center for Reproductive Rights. Find more news and commentary on the ongoing state and federal campaigns to erode abortion rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.